Good afternoon. It's 2:59 p.m. on KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. It's time for Juneau Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for today. Today's show will continue our Fish 101 series with Pete Schneider, who will showcase the Steep Creek Fish Cam. We'll talk about Tracy Arm Tours with Steve Weber. We'll hear a story with Annie Bartholomew on artist Ricky Tagaban. And we'll be talking with Kimberly Vaughn about the Frank Mayer Marathon. All these guests, Writer's Almanac, music, Bird Note, more, Tuesday, July 22nd, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Lac du Flambeau recently celebrated the tribe's purchase of the historic Strawberry Island in northern Wisconsin. As WXPR's Natalie Jablonski reports, the land was privately held for more than 100 years.
About 100 people gathered on Sand Beach in Lac du Flambeau, across from the island that gets its name from its strawberry-like shape. It's the site of an important battle between the Ojibwe and the Sioux peoples. Lac du Flambeau chairman Tom Molson says it's also spiritually important.
You know, it's an island that has some very religious significance, and it's been, I guess, in the arms of the Ojibwe people here in Waswaganeen for hundreds of years until it was, you know, taken under some type of, I guess, under false pretenses by non-Indian people.
The island ended up in non-tribal hands in 1910, but when the landowners made plans to build on the island, it prompted outcry from tribal members who felt the island should remain undeveloped. After years of negotiations with the tribe unable to afford the asking price, the parties finally came to an agreement. In December, Lac du Flambeau bought Strawberry Island for $250,000. Melinda Young, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, says it's more than just a land acquisition.
Just for the fact that it's back, it belongs to us again. I mean, that to me is the ultimate. I can't think of another space aside from where we have, you know, our ancestors resting. I can't think of another space that is more important to my community. To me, I think this is our heart.
Wisconsin State Senator Bob Jauch attended the celebration, as did representatives from the Bad River and Sakagan Chippewa bands. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski.
Chivac, a remote village on the Bering Sea in southwest Alaska, will soon have an imagination library. The community is hundreds of miles from the nearest Alaska road system. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Elvina Echirian worked at the Head Start School in Chivac. She says she wanted to start an imagination library in her village to better prepare the kids for school.
When I was a teacher aide for LCAP, in the checkpoints, the kids were low in literacy and math. We're hoping that the kids will benefit from this program from receiving free books.
The Imagination Library is a nationwide program that sends an age-appropriate book once a month to any child who is enrolled in the program for free. It's administered through Best Beginnings in Alaska. Project manager Laura Cisneros says there are proven benefits for the children from this program.
There's research that shows that they develop a greater love of reading because of this program, and our hope is that it's also helping create that special family time where parents and family members are reading with their children.
Cisneros also says the book comes directly to the child, adding another element of excitement.
It's not just coming to mom or to dad or to grandma or grandpa or the guardian. It actually has the child's name on it, so the child is getting their very own piece of mail every month.
CHIVAC will be the 34th local imagination library in Alaska. Local imagination libraries require 5 volunteers. Echirian says there are enough volunteers for the committee needed to run the program in Chivac, and says the kids might get their first books by October this year. Imagination Library is a program founded by country music singer and songwriter Dolly Parton in 1995. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Young Native males were among attendees at a town hall Monday with President Obama, who discussed the My Brother's Keeper initiative. The program aims to help young men of color succeed. Obama fielded questions from the audience. One issue he touched on was Native language and culture. It was also announced that the National Congress of American Indians will lead a task force, which will include a group of Native organizations that work with young people. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org.
Not voting is not rebelling, it's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org. Brought to you by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Our first guest on the show today is Pete Schneider, who is from the U.S. Forest Service, Juneau Ranger District, and he's going to talk about the Steep Creek Fish Cam. But first off, I want to introduce him and ask him what his background is as a fisheries biologist. Welcome to the studio, Pete.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for having me. My background as a Forest Service fisheries biologist is lots of seasonal time. I started off in college, and I ended up getting a degree in zoology at the University of Idaho, go Vandals. And I had a professor there that encouraged me to do some work for the Forest Service. I was hoping he didn't say volunteer work, and he didn't. He just said work, and actually got paid to work there in the summers, and it turned out to be just a great job. And I wound up here. I bounced around a lot of places down south working different seasonal jobs and came up here, and this is a great place to be a fisheries biologist, of course.
How did you come up with the idea for the fish cam? And let's talk about the approval process, because I know how slowly the federal government works on things.
Oh, you realize that, huh? Yeah. Let's see. So the idea did not originate with me. That originated back in, I believe it's 1995, and Matt Statsny was a Eagle Scout, and that he actually worked on this project to get his Eagle Scout, and it started off with him putting a camera in the creek and running a live feed to just a TV at what's known as the Pavilion. That's that nice covered overlook at the glacier, right at the end of the parking lot. And, of course, that just serves just the folks that come to the visitor center and all the tourists, and it was very well received. And so when I got the job, that became one of my duties. My boss had said, hey, this is one of your responsibilities. That would be Don Martin. He had encouraged me to get in on that and maybe take it to another level. So that's how it started.
That was the genesis for the fish cam.
Right, and like I said, I believe he did that as his Eagle Scout project, and so it's blossomed from there. We not only did that, we eventually put a second monitor TV up at the main building, the visitor center, so we could have it in two locations, and it became pretty popular. We upgraded the cameras, and over time we had a power failure and some upgrades out there. We had to dig new line, and we had some kids that got in trouble for lighting fireworks, and so they had to do some community service. And so it worked out great. Those kids, they helped us dig the line. It's not fun to dig out there. It's pretty rocky, of course. And anyway, they helped us dig a whole new line. We laid new cable and everything, and we were able to run a second monitor up at the main building. So we had two TVs, but the key was once I got up to the main building, that's where the internet service is at. So then a very dim light bulb went off, and I thought, oh, maybe I can get this on the internet. So that's the approval process. Then you're right, you're led on to something that is very difficult in the Forest Service and government in general, I suppose, is that things do take a long time.
And especially new ideas.
Right, yeah. that was a hurdle. It was definitely a hurdle. So we have the fish cam running live, and it's been a couple years now. But it was not easy at first. We were limited mostly by our own ignorance, and I'm talking we meaning me. And I had a guy working for me, and we brainstormed. We're fish guys. We weren't really computer savvy. So we learned just a little bit here and there, and we were able to figure out a way to get at least static images to upload. But, of course, the public not very interested in that. And what it took was for me to I ended up hiring a kid fresh out of college, 25. He knew just what to do, and within a matter of 2 weeks, he had us online, and it's something that I hadn't been able to really do for a year. But then the key was we had to make sure the Forest Service didn't shut us down. I'm not getting into all the details, but at the visitor center they have a partner up there, and that allows them to have a little more flexibility to have some of their internet service. And the key was to be able to put this signal outside the quote unquote Forest Service firewall to be able to upload the image. And so we figured out a way to do that. And the manager, Ron Marvin, at the time up at the visitor center, he liked the idea and he said, "Hey, I'm all for it. I won't tell anybody if you won't." And we kind of figured if we could get that out there and people saw it and they liked it, then we were golden. And that's exactly what happened. It got some publicity. People liked it. We got great feedback. And pretty soon the fact that we may or may not have bypassed some of the regulations in terms of the how you're allowed to get that signal out there, those went by the wayside.
All right, the viewership has been tremendous on this. I know that the online response has been fabulous, and you've actually received an award for this. So tell everybody what the Rise to Future Award is and who qualifies for that.
That was quite an honor. It was really, really an honor. It's the Rise to the Future Award is basically designed. It's a Forest Service award. But it doesn't have to go specifically to Forest Service employees. Some of the recipients in the past and I'm sure will be in the future are partners with the agency. But it's basically an award to give to fisheries and hydrologist personnel and to recognize efforts. And they have, I think it's about a dozen categories. And there's for different things, restoration and for the category I had was a public relations type thing, different categories. And every year they review projects that were done with Forest Service partnership or money, with a fisheries or hydrology related theme. And, I was nominated last fall for the fish cam. And last year was a very successful year for the fish cam, and I can tell you more about why that came to be too. But
certainly, go
yeah,
ahead.
So the Rise of the Future Award came out, and it was I had gotten nominated, and I was lucky enough to receive one of the awards. So it was fantastic. But we have been online in 2008. I'd mentioned we first had static images, but that's pretty boring, of course, and. By 2009, within 2 weeks of that college kid showing up, he had us online, and we just basically using a free encoding software package, and so it went from there. And I got approval to be able to make a link, and it has evolved continuously to the point where the folks at the Washington office, which is the headquarters for the Forest Service, they were interested and supportive, and have remained very supportive of the project, and they have said, "Hey, what do you think about putting this on YouTube?" Because we were actually paying a hosting company to we would upload the image to the video to them, and then they would host it. That way, that little computer I got sitting in the back closet up at the visitor center didn't crash with all the people viewing it. And but they said, "Hey, what about uploading to YouTube? We think we can do that." And that's what really made this much more accessible, because before you had to go to the Forest Service website, the Tongass webpage, or maybe the regional office webpage. And, you know, sad to say, it doesn't get a lot of traffic. There's not a lot of folks going to that. So when we put it on YouTube, you could still link to it through those pages, but people could also do a search for, well, who knows what people search for on YouTube. But that's what really made it go crazy, and the viewership skyrocketed.
Hi, Pete, physically, how deep is the camera set up, and what kind of action has been seen over the last couple of years, fish-wise?
Right. Oh, well, so it's surprisingly shallow. The camera is a little deceiving. Of course, you know, things underwater look larger than they really are, but the camera is, it's only like 12 inches of water. It's not that deep. Now, I have it set up so it's aimed towards a spot where the fish are likely to sit and hang out for a while, and that's a little bit of a deeper pool. Any good fisherman knows that if you want to go find fish, you look for pools, and that's of course where the sockeye will tend to hang out. So it's really not that deep. The camera itself is just in a flexible conduit. It's an analog camera. It's fairly simple. I just have to put everything in conduit out there because the beavers and porcupines and bears will chew whatever, and of course they would chew through that.
Oh,
heartbeat.
Chew through wire, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. So far so good. Knock on wood, they haven't messed with any of the stuff out there, but we do have to lock it up pretty good. And then as far as things that we've seen, obviously the sockeye, they're just coming in now. In fact, we had right before the eucalypt, we had a whole bunch of fish come in. But then when it all flooded with the eucalypt, they headed back downstream. And they're still downstream. They hang out in this beaver pond that's right between the stream mouth and Mendenhall Lake. And they're hanging out right in there right now. They're not heading up the stream. But you'll see all kinds of activity. Obviously, one of the most memorable ones is when you get the bears. Every once in a while, the bears will reach right into that pool and pull out a fish that's just about dead. They don't do that until they start getting kind of hungry. But that's always fun. And you'll see an occasional duck or merganser paddle by. Beavers will go by. River otter. That's typically some of the stuff you see. Coho fry will come hang out by the camera.
All right, Pete, in addition to YouTube, is there any other place where people could find the camera or getting in for more information about the U.S. Forest Service in general?
Right. Oh, yeah. So if you go to YouTube, you could type in Steep Creek Fish Cam, and it'll take you right to that. The other option is to go to the Tongass page. So that's www.fs.usda.gov/Tongass, and there'll be a link right on there that'll take you, it essentially takes you to the YouTube site, and that'll be the link. So that's how you can check out the cam. And I was just checking it out a little while ago. It's pretty quiet in there right now. Like I said, the sockeye are still not committed to coming up the stream, but it'll come. It looks like it may be soon because it's going to start raining here.
Okay, Pete Snyder, the Steep Creek Fish Cam. That's kind of like a fish channel, all fish all the time.
Right, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, right. That's where you get your fish fix.
All right, thank you very much for being our guest in the studio today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Was a little bit of Sting with a song called All This Time, and we'll be right back with our next guest after Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 22nd of July, 2014.
It's the birthday of the novelist Tom Robbins, author of Another Roadside Attraction, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, born Blowing Rock, North Carolina, 1936. Selman Abraham Waxman, the biochemist, born in Ukraine on this day, 1888. He was the discoverer of streptomycin, the first effective treatment of tuberculosis. It's the birthday of the woman who wrote The Velveteen Rabbit, Marjorie Williams Bianco, born London, 1881. It's the birthday of the authority on etiquette. Amy Vanderbilt's complete book of etiquette sold millions of copies starting back in 1952. Amy Vanderbilt, born New York City, 1908. She was the cousin of the famous Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, the railway magnate. It's the birthday of the Moravian scientist, meteorologist Johann Gregor Mendel, born Czechoslovakia, 1822, who for about 7 years performed experiments on 28,000 edible pea plants, and from his observations developed his theory of inheritance, including the idea of recombination of genes, which became the basis of the modern science of genetics. It's the birthday of the painter Edward Hopper, Nyack, New York, 1882. Worked as an illustrator at an ad agency in New York, which he loathed, and in his spare time he drove around, painted train stations, gas stations, and corner saloons. He'd sold only one painting, Hopper had, by the time he was 40, and then came his first major exhibition, 1933, at the Museum of Modern Art, which made him famous. Edward Hopper, who said, "All I ever wanted to do was to paint sunlight on the side of a house." And it's the birthday of the poet Stephen Vincent Benet, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 1898, author of John Brown's Body, who said, "Life is not lost by dying. Life is lost minute by minute, day by dragging day, in all the thousand small, uncaring ways." Here's a poem for today by Jack Gilbert, "Cherishing What Isn't." "Ah, you three women whom I have loved in this long life, along with the few others and the four I may have loved or stopped short of loving, I wander through these woods making songs of you, some of regret, some of longing, and a terrible one of death. I carry the privacy of your bodies and hearts in me, the shameful ardor and the shameless intimacy, the secret kinds of happiness and the walled-up childhoods. I carol loudly of you among trees emptied of winter and rejoice quietly in summer. A score of women, if you count love, both large and small, real ones that were brief and those that lasted. Gentle love, and some almost like an animal with its prey. What is left is what's alive in me. The failing of your beauty and its remaining. You are like countries in which my love took place, like a bell in the trees that makes your music in each wind that moves, a music composed of what you have forgotten that will end with my ending." Jack Gilbert's poem, "Cherishing What Isn't," from The Dance Most of All, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Jay Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from North End Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. Northland Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
And the Juno Afternoon continues. I'm Ken Fix, your host. And with me in the studio now is Steve Weber, and he is the man behind Adventure Bound Alaska Tours. And it's a pleasure to have him in the studio with us. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Ken. It sure is nice to be here.
Okay. Well, the big question I've got for you is what has been so fascinating about Tracy Arm that you've made a career out of bringing tourists to it? You've been doing this for over 21 years.
Oh, I just think about the incredible consistency of the beauty. There's just something every day that motivates a person. It just can't be beat. It's that good.
All right. And can you describe the uniqueness of a fjord versus, like, say, a bay or an inlet? What's the difference? What makes a fjord a fjord?
Well, a fjord is it is indeed an inlet, but it's a special kind of inlet. It's one that's carved out by glaciers. They left behind steep rock walls, and the steepness continues underwater to where you have deep water. And also, it's a seaway. It's an ocean. It's ocean water, it's tide water. And so let's say you have a body of water that's fresh water that's carved out by a glacier type thing. Well, that's called a lake, but ours is a fjord. And you got adjacent valleys, you've got the deep water, you got the tide water activity. It comes to an end. It's not like a passage. So you go into a fjord, you have to come out of that same fjord the same way you came in. So those are some of the basic features of a fjord.
Okay, and you run two ships into Tracy Arm. When would you use one versus the other?
Oh, it's more a customer demand, Ken, you know, up and down. Sometimes we have enough demand to run both boats, and it's just whatever level that seems to make sense for which boat to use. One will cost a little more to operate than the other. So, you know, one has a load factor of up to 50, the other one up to 40. And one burns a little more fuel than the other because of the size differences. So we just kind of wing it there to see which boats we're using as much as we can. We like to use both boats, of course.
And since you've been doing this for over 21 years, every excursion, I imagine, is different. Can you describe some of the things that you would usually see on the tour?
Well, there are a lot of things. There's some wildlife. Sometimes we see whales, although we're not a dedicated whale watching operation. Sometimes we do pretty good, incidental to the rest of the trip. We see bears. We see seals. And then there's the ice itself. My gosh, it can vary a lot. We can have easy access to the glacier, or we can have thick ice where we have to stand back a little farther. We've got the most beautiful icebergs you'll see in all the Tidewater Glacier viewing areas. Big and blue color. They come off from the base of the glacier because the glacier themselves are quite deep. The small one is 600 feet deep at the face underwater. And then the larger one up to 900 feet. And with that deep water, they break off big pieces underneath, and up you have a big iceberg.
All right. How often do the calving events occur? And are there specific weather conditions or times of the summer where the calving is more prevalent than others?
Okay. Well, we have a good calving throughout. Every trip, we have some sort of event. In fact, we actually guarantee calving. If someone doesn't see calving, we'll give them another ride at no charge. But it can vary with the conditions. I would say if you were going to plan it during a really rainy period with a big low tide, that would probably guarantee some pretty big calving. But most people aren't going to pick that rainy day. They're going to want the sunny day. But also in the fjord itself, we always get better weather there than back in town. So as soon as you figure out, you think you've got it figured out, you find out that it does something different. So you got to be open-minded and look for great things every time.
Right. I know your tours are extremely popular in Juneau, and I don't think you can just say, well, gee, it looks like a really nice day. Maybe I can get on the ship, because your tours book out fairly far in advance, don't they?
Well, some do, but gosh, we welcome people to come in the morning and see if we have space. We do live for that some days. Most folks do make an advance reservation. It's something that people plan out, yes.
Okay, and I have personally been out with you three different times, and yeah, I will testify that it is a unique experience, and it's different every time. It's probably the best bang for your buck that you can get in this town on a tour.
Well, we try to be good to our guests that way. We know that, families make a commitment to go out, and it does add up pretty fast on any kind of activity in town. Ours is a full day, is 10 hours, and going out, there's great things to see going out. And we're in the fjord for 6 hours, and it's we call it power sightseeing, Ken. And by the end of the day, you're tired and you're really fulfilled. There's so many things to see.
Yeah, I can hardly understand how you can do this, because you do this for 10 hours a day, and you do it from, what, May till pretty much the end of September?
That's correct. And I have to give credit to my crew, Ken. They do such a good job. Got some college students. I got some adults here that live in town. Got one deckhand. She's been with us for 13 years, and she loves this job. And I do, sometimes I'll hire a high school student with the notion that maybe I can get them through high school and have them stick with us through college, too. Like one of our deckhands, he's just become a pharmacist. Another an airline pilot. So it's a good starting job for a lot of folks.
Okay, and is there anything that you've had over the last 21 years that's especially memorable?
I think overall the consistency on great activities at the glacier, big calving events that are astonishing, and I think that's the thing that really stands out.
Okay, and how have those glaciers changed over the course of 21 years? Like me going out there, just on the third trip over a couple of years, I don't really notice much difference. Have you been able to notice anything?
Oh, big time. And, we've had guests that have been with us for those 21 years, and they'll tell you every trip is different. And when we started in 94 running the regular trips, South Sawyer Glacier was out about a mile from where it is now. Sawyer Glacier, more commonly called North Sawyer, was out about a mile and a half from where it is now. But both of them had a period of rapid retreat, consistent on North Sawyer, and it was pretty radical in 2004, 5, and 6 on South Sawyer. But since then, both of the glaciers have been rather stable, I would say. They both advance and retreat. Advance meaning pushing out more ice than they break off. Retreating, meaning breaking off more ice than they push out. And seasonally, in the winter and the spring, they'll push out more. They'll advance. And in the summer and into the fall, they'll retreat. But overall, these last 8 years, they've stayed pretty consistent with their relationship to the rock walls on each side. And I think that's probably one of the biggest surprises that people have seen, is just how they've kind of stopped where they are.
Okay, and at one point, had both of those started out as one glacier? And then I know that there's a point where each one of them sort of retreated into its own specific arm. So at one point, was it all one glacier? And probably not in your time, but did it all start out that way from the time of discovery?
Yes, indeed.
Was it two separate glaciers when they discovered it?
Well, John Muir's earliest writings, he talks about one glacier. So that would mean that they were merged together outside of what we call Sawyer Island right now, and they could not see that there were two glaciers flowing together. It was one. But as time went by, I retreated, and then now you obviously have the two.
Okay, and let's talk about the two ships that you take down there. There's the Adventure Bound, and there's the Captain Cook. Both of those, do they have any special equipment on there? Because that leads me to another question, is how close do you get in, and what determines whether you go in a little bit closer with the volume of ice in there?
Well, both boats have had some modifications made to the hull and the running gear. Oversized shafts, V-struts, protective skags that stick down from that. The hulls themselves have had reinforced beams put down both inside and outside to where we have 5-inch thick in critical places. And we wouldn't want to undertake what we're doing without those reinforcements. But mainly, though, you try to avoid the ice. Rule number one, go around it. Rule number two, go slow. And slow is really hard to define. It depends on how thick the ice is. And there's variations every day. And so you just have to look for the best route. And take it easy. You don't want to smash anything, Ken. You just,
yeah,
no smashing.
We all know how that works out.
No. Bad relationship between boats and icebergs. I think some people know about that. So you have to gently negotiate with that ice, and you always have to figure it'll win if you push too hard.
Okay, and while the icebergs are definitely the stars of the tour, what other encounters do you have on the way down and back? We're talking specifically wildlife. What can people see?
Oh, bears. 80% this year so far. Orca, we're looking maybe 75%. No, got that backwards. Only about a quarter of our trips on the orca. On humpbacks, we've been 100% this year. Some really good, others off in the distance. But we've had our chances, and we appreciate the bonuses of the wildlife.
Okay, remind everybody where they can go to get more information about the tours that you run.
We're at 76 Egan Drive in downtown, right across from the Gold Belt Hotel. It's the first commercial building you find right after the Coast Guard Station and the NOAA dock there. And it's easy to pull in there and check for information, make a reservation, and then the staff can show you where you can park.
Okay, and there is also a website that people can go to.
AdventureBoundAlaska.com ought to do it.
All right, and I noticed there's pictures and there's some YouTube video clips on the website. Primarily glacier, big-time glacier calving. So.
Yeah, I think they're easy enough to find.
Okay, Steve Weber for Adventure Bound Tours Alaska, thank you very much for being our guest in the studio today.
All right, thanks for letting me come in here. I've really enjoyed it.
Now, you may have guessed that Steve actually wasn't in the studio right now with me. That interview was recorded earlier. He's probably just on his way out of Tracy Arm right now. So for Steve and the crew of Venture Bound Alaska, here's Blue's image with Ride Captain Ride. That was Blue's image with Ride Captain Ride. And now we're going to hear a story by Annie Bartholomew on Native artist Ricky Tagaban. So let's listen in.
In his living room overlooking the Gastineau Channel in Juneau, Ricky Tagaban is spinning wool and wet cedar bark together on moose hide. The process joins the fibers together, creating something called warp, which will give Tagaban's bags their structure. With a big celebration cultural event just a few days away, Tagaban still has several commissions left to fulfill. Though his finished pieces vary in size and intricacy, they all begin the same way, as cedar bark softening in a crock pot.
Cooking it is kind of the longest part. And then I soak the bark in hot water and spin it with the wool, and I have to wash it and groom it. And that part, that's called grooming your balls. And you have to go along and cut all the fluff. And that's all before weaving.
Tagaban is weaving in the Chilkat tradition. The textile technique is passed down through Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian families. And there are strict rules guiding its practice. Created on an upright loom, Chilkat uses abstract shapes and patterns inspired by nature. Much of what's known about Chilkat came from the late master weaver, Jenny Clinat. Juno weaver Lily Hudson Hope has been practicing both Raven's Tail and later Chilkat weaving since she was a teenager.
I feel like the traditions and the rules and the taboos are set there, and they're there to protect us.
One of the taboos in Chilkat is to never place a human hand in designs. Another is to always cover up your work after you're finished. But the one that applies to Tagaban is that men can't weave. But Hope says there is one exception.
We don't know why it started or where it started, but when Jenny was teaching my mother and other weavers in 1986, she would scream, "We don't teach men. I don't teach men. We don't teach men." And then she made the exception that if they're funny, and she said, "If they're funny, I teach him." They're funny in the way that they're two-spirited.
By two-spirited, Hope means gay. In the summer of 2010, Tagaban was invited to learn from Clinat's apprentice and Hope's mother, Clarissa Rizal, because he fit the tradition and was identified as someone who could carry it forward.
I was asked to learn this style of weaving because of my sexual orientation, and it's a Native art form. So learning this and practicing it and really identifying as a weaver has reconciled my Nativeness and my gayness.
Since learning Chilkat, Tagaban's work has become more elaborate and experimental, incorporating more modern materials like shotgun shells. This spring, Tagaban was awarded his second Rasmussen grant, and one of his iPhone bags appeared on the red carpet in Los Angeles at the GLAAD Media Awards. Hope thinks it's exciting to see the way Tagaban has brought Chilkat to new audiences.
He's taken an ancient art form and put it in the hands of the masses in a way that's revolutionary. We don't have to wait for celebration or for cultural gatherings to share our art form with other people. It's not just for Tlingit people or just for Haidas or Tsimshian. It's like, if you like this and you want to wear this, come have some. Come get it.
Back at Tagaban's home studio, he lets me try on a pair of leggings decorated by deer hooves. They're a work in progress, an old-world object with a twist. Embedded in the traditional Chilkat pattern is a small patch of geometric raven's tail weaving, a hybrid design that's just beginning to gain acceptance in Chilkat. For Tagaban, harmonizing both aspects, the modern and traditional, is important.
It's cool to have, like, a really specialized skill. It's also kind of a lot of pressure. It's not that we're saving it, it's just that we're holding on to it while we're here.
The leggings are almost finished. Tagaban just has to sew sea otter fur to the tops before he can see them dance to the celebration. In Juneau, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
Well, thanks, Annie, for that interview. It's 3:42 p.m., and a Juneau afternoon continues in just a moment. But first, a public service announcement. Juneau Lyric Opera's Midsummer Vocal Festival starts Monday, July 28th, and it's a Broadway splash summer. When Juneau Lyric Opera asked the singers what they wanted to sing this summer, Broadway music won. And this summer's festival will be exploring the world of musical theater. Over the years, some of the greatest American music has come from the Broadway stage. And as America changed, Broadway reimagined itself to reflect the world around it. The Juneau Lyric Opera will be singing some of that great music, from the classics of the Broadway stage to the cutting edge of today's theater, with some film music thrown in for good measure. Classes will be held from 7 to 9:30 p.m. weekday evenings, starting July 28th. First week rehearsals will be downtown at Holy Trinity Church, and the second week rehearsals will be in the choir room at Thunder Mountain High School. The performance will be at Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium Saturday, August 9th at 7:30 p.m. The registration fee is $100, and participants may register and pay the first night of class. Returning guest artists will be Dr. Byron McGilvray and Janice Capel. This is Dr. McGilvray's 25th season coming to Juneau to conduct choral workshops. Over the years, he's been given private lessons, taught sight singing, performance classes, conducting, music history, and more to Juneau singers. And for more information on Juneau Lyric Opera, you can contact them at 586-ARIA. That's Alpha Romeo India Alpha, ARIA. 586-ARIA. Juneau Afternoon will continue in just a moment.
Substance abuse can be both a cause and a consequence of homelessness. The U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness estimates nearly half of everyone experiencing homelessness suffers from substance abuse disorders. Join us at 360 on Tuesday, July 22nd for Living with Substance Abuse, a roof town hall discussion. Doors open at 5 p.m.
Imagine walking into your favorite fast food restaurant and ordering 150 hamburger big meals with large fries, and then you eat the whole pile that weighs about as much as you do. It might take you all day, but you finish them off, totaling up somewhere in the neighborhood of 165,000 calories, about 100 times more calories than a normal person needs for a day. Now imagine that you eat your weight in burgers and fries again the next day and the day after that. Not because you own stock in the company or you're in love with burgers and fries, but because if you don't do it, you'll starve to death. Well, now you know what it's like to be a shrew. The life of a shrew is pretty much a constant search for food, only the shrew doesn't have a fast food restaurant to go to. They have to search out and eat their weight in insects, earthworms, slugs, spiders, and other healthful organic snacks every day. So what's going on with the shrew, you might ask? Or where the heck can I get a metabolism like that? Well, there's a principle here that accounts for the shrew's need for huge amounts of food. Warm-blooded animals spend a portion of their energy budget maintaining body temperature. That's a fancy way of saying that much of the food they eat is converted to heat. The biggest loss of body heat is through the skin of an animal, and shrews are the world's smallest mammals and have the highest proportion of skin to body weight. So the heat just pours out through the shrew's skin as fast as food is consumed and turned to heat. A shrew has to hunt down and eat food equal to its body weight or more every day, or it's in danger of starving. One of the most common shrews of North America, the masked shrew, weighs only 1/5 of an ounce. For those of you in the metric system, that's about 6 grams. And for those who have a tough time relating to both the English and the metric system, that's roughly the weight of 2 soda crackers. The pygmy shrew, found in most of the same places as the masked shrew, is even smaller. It weighs only 1 soda cracker. And if you think the masked shrew has it bad when it comes to rustling up groceries, the pygmy shrew must eat 3 times its body weight every day or starve. In fact, if it goes an hour without food, 1 hour, it dies of starvation. The pygmy shrew hunts for food all day and all night. My friend Art and I were hunting moose one September in the interior of Alaska. We'd just pulled our boat up alongside the bank of a slough next to camp, and Art said, "Look at that!" There was a splash and a swirl of water near a little brown animal. It was running in circles on the floating vegetation. It was so tiny, it had to be a shrew. We watched that shrew investigating every nook and cranny of the broken-over weeds lying on top of the water when suddenly it stopped and didn't move again. Well, carefully we eased a paddle under the little animal and brought it into the boat. The shrew laid there, lifeless. We had witnessed an event neither one of us had ever seen before, the end of the life of a shrew. 1 minute it was on its perpetual quest for food, and the next, it was gone. Now, the heartbeat of a shrew can climb to 1,200 beats per minute. That's 20 beats per second when it's excited. That swirl in the water was probably a northern pike trying to have the shrew for lunch. Had the excitement of that near miss caused the shrew's heart to beat so fast it finally gave out? We'll never know. I've seen a lot of shrews out in the woods, mostly while in a duck blind or on a deer stand. Sometimes they pause and look me over, little beady eyes squinting up at me from a brush pile, their sharp-pointed snouts and whiskers wiggling. I suspect there's 2 things going through their little brains. The first is that big thing edible? Quickly followed by, can I take 'em? No, I've never been attacked by a shrew, but I think we ought to count our blessings that shrews don't grow to the size of Labrador retrievers. The next time you're out in the woods and a shrew happens across your path, you might think about that. Let them go on their way in their constant search for worms and spiders. Be thankful that your diet is a lot more tasty. Just tip your cap and say, good hunting, as it goes on its way.
Hey, are you interested in music? Would you like to share your enthusiasm with KRNN listeners? We're looking for volunteer announcers to host a variety of radio programs. Don't worry if you don't have experience. We'll train you like they did me. And if you've always wanted to be on the air, give Jeff Brown a call at 463-6425, or you can email him at jeff@ktoo.org. Thanks.
This is Bird Note. By midsummer, many shrubs that in May shone boldly with flowers are now bearing fruit. Fruit that birds find irresistible. Elderberries, serviceberries, blackberries, dogwoodberries, mulberries, currants, and dozens of others. Waxwings, tanagers, robins, grosbeaks, even tiny warblers feast on nature's bounty. We might think that plants are being generous by offering such a rich supply of nutritious fruits. In truth, something other than largesse is at work here. Plants evolved fruits as a kind of bribe, a way of enticing mobile creatures like birds to ingest their seeds. Birds then excrete those seeds hours later as they move widely about the landscape. Plants themselves take no metabolic benefit from the sweet pulp of their fruits. Instead, they offer this bounty in exchange for birds' help in distributing their seedlings in new locations. Flowering plants also rely on winged animals for pollination. And in dispersing pollen, birds, bats, and insects also help guarantee a new crop of berries, those brightly hued reminders of mutual benefit, the co-evolution between plants and animals. Today's show is brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
That was the remainder of Blues Images' Ride, Captain Ride. I didn't think I'd have time to finish that one today. Okay, a public service announcement. Tomorrow, Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities will conduct aerial surveys for bald eagle nests in the Juneau area tomorrow morning. Between the times of 9:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m., DOT and PF staff will use a Temsco helicopter to survey along the North Douglas Highway between Douglas Bridge and Fish Creek Road, along Glacier Highway from Eagle Beach Beach to the Cascade Point and 440 to 490 block of Thane Road. The purpose of the survey is to determine the status and occupancy of eagle nests in proximity to DOT and PF construction activities. For more information, you can contact Dale Palmer, DOT and PF Southeast Region, phone number 480-560-7807, or you can email dane.palmer@alaska.gov. Today's forecast for the remainder of the day is mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and highs in the mid-60s. Southeast winds at about 10 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow is going to be mostly cloudy again with a chance of rain. Winds in the morning are going to be rather light and variable. Tomorrow night, cloudy, chance of rain with lows in the low 50s and light winds. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on the following translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay areas, you can tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens in on K201 AM 88.1, and K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Digital Channel 871. KRNN can be heard on digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found on 873. We're also online at ktoo.org, and we rely on support from listeners like you for our public broadcasting. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host for the Juneau Afternoon today, and I hope to see you again next week. Take care.
More news from Gaza, where the casualties continue to...